Welcome to the Literacy Fellows podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Gabriel.
After a long hiatus, we're back with a short series where I get to explore the different chapters of my new book, Doing Disciplinary Literacy, which is out with Teachers College Press the summer of 2023. We've got a little twist in this series. Instead of me interviewing other people, a friend of mine, Dr. Richard Robinson, is going to be interviewing me. So I'll turn it right over.
So I just wanted to have a conversation because I've really enjoyed reading your book so far. I think it's really good for teachers on the front lines to really have a look into what some of the words that they hear all the time that are used maybe really mean and could mean in practice.
Awesome.
So when I read chapter two, I just wanted to talk about chapter two, if that's okay.
Yeah.
And just pull out a few quotes and things, or just maybe some main ideas. So when I read your chapter two, I don't know if you intended this, probably not from the title, but what I got out of it was there were two things, equity and student experience. So equity popped out at me when you were talking about, for some students, the ways disciplinary learning opportunities have been truncated for them in school settings by the separation of content learning from the literacies required to do the discipline. So can you talk about some of the ways maybe that you have, what does that look like for a teacher that's walking and observing another teacher, for example, in a middle school classroom? What might it look like when I walk into the room and see that things have been truncated for certain groups of students?
I think there's two things that I look for. One is that the kids don't have their eyes or hands on text during the lesson at any point. Now, there are certainly things that you would be doing or you could be doing that don't require a text. That's totally fine. It's not like they have to be glued to a book. But if you make it through 45 minutes, an hour of instruction or activity, like if they really are engaged in activity for the entire period, and there's no representation of content that they're making meaning from, or they aren't creating a representation of content, then they're not doing it. They're watching it be done, or they're playing around with some of the stuff. And keep in mind, like, I'm not saying the textbook, I'm saying any representation of the thing that they're studying. So they could be working with so many different things. And if you don't see them working with representations of content, then what are they doing? They're playing or they are having that sort of the teacher do it at them, for them.
Yes.
Or the video do it for them or at them, to them. The other thing that it can look like is that this is something that I see pretty frequently in settings where the school has been told that they're failing or certain tracks of kids have been told that they're failing. I see a lot of teachers trying to quote unquote bridge the gap by rewriting a bunch of the materials. And there is, this is one of those things where it's not always a wrong idea, but always doing it is a wrong idea.
Ooh, tell me more about that.
So it is possible that your best case scenario for getting kids moving toward really working with the ideas of the discipline. And I'll give you an example in a second, so it's not so abstract. It's possible that the best way to kind of do a stepping stone there is to recreate something for them that is a little bit closer to what they know how to do. But if you find yourself always recreating for them, then they aren't moving. And what you have recreated isn't a good enough representation for them to actually grow. So I think I watched a high school chorus teacher was introducing a new piece to the kids. This is not something they could have sight read on their own. It's not something they will understand anytime soon. It's in, you know, using things that they don't know yet, but she wanted them to engage with it. And so she picked a chunk and without the music in front of them at all, she sang it to them, they sang it back, and they back and forth a bunch. And then she showed them where it was in the text. And she played and sang like on the way to it. they sang that part, mm-hmm. kept going. So that's a really good way of kind of simplifying the task to, so it's where kids can actually access it and then mm-hmm. building toward full participation. It also sometimes looks like, you know, in practice with other groups, it looks like basically a gradual release of responsibility, but it isn't always that the teacher is responsible. Sometimes the students are doing a far approximation and then a closer and closer one. So like just clapping the rhythms and then
yes.
just doing it on like with one kind of articulation and then sort of layering in the parts. What that looks like with a text in like social studies or science is that they are relying more on video and teacher explanation and then following it up with text. And then that balance shifts over time.
So, so that was something, I'm sorry.
What you don't want to see, which I used to kind of joke about, and then I worked in a building where people were doing it left and right, and I had to stop joking, was like, you know, you go to a like before school starts summer PD, and it says it's really important for kids to read at or close to their reading level, and the science and social studies and maybe even math teachers go back to their rooms and check the reading level of their textbook, and it's way too high. It's even yep. higher than their grade level, and they know their kids are kind of below or at, and so they stack it in the hallway for the janitor to take away because this can't wow. be in my classroom. None of my kids can read it. Well, probably yes. they can't read it word for word, left to right, top to bottom, every page by themselves.
Correct. But
probably there are things in there that they can read, and you could be extending that, you know, capacity across the year so that they actually are
interesting.
Seeing it.
If I hear you right, it's about scaffolding in a way that does not hinder growth, mm-hmm. But meets the child where they're at. An yeah. interesting thing that you said that I was in a recent meeting, teachers at the secondary level are really talking about AI
yeah.
in an interesting one good way. That we're hearing that you might be able to use AI is to take a text, yep. give it, and very quickly turn it to a level that a student can read at. So now we can yeah. imagine that this is going to be very ubiquitous, where any teacher now can very quickly mm-hmm. turn it to their level.
Yeah.
So I think that that's going to be really interesting to see. Do you see that that could be a problem, or isn't that great that now we can take any text and hand it to a child at their level?
Yeah, so there have been programs that'll do that for you for a while, but they're not as widespread as like now. You're absolutely right. Like now it's at everybody's fingertips and everyone can imagine doing it.
Yes.
We've been thinking about this for a while because there are a bunch of websites that'll do it for mm-hmm. like Newsy LA will do it for all of their news articles. There's other resources that kind of make use of that programming. The challenge is that when you use the computer to make a change in text level, they're changing the familiarity of vocabulary. They're going to use more common words, and they're changing the length of sentences to be shorter. And that may or may right. not either make it easier or turn it into a text that you would want to read. But the main the disciplinary problem with that is that you'll be explaining concepts without using the patterns and vocabulary of the discipline. And when you're in secondary, the choice of words for explaining things is part of the complexity of the text, but it's also part of the conceptual complexity. And so you're just not able to understand it at a high level. And this is the equity piece. If you put a really complicated concept into a kid's dictionary, they give you a really simple version of what that concept is. And if that's the only thing that your students are exposed to, they have no opportunity to engage with the complexity of the idea because you gave them a simple text.
Oh, that's really good.
Yeah. So.
Or really bad, but yes, that's.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah, that's a yeah. very interesting. Yes.
So I worked with this group of teachers that we were doing this project about coastal literacy. Connecticut has a nice big long coastline. Not all of it is accessible. but a good chunk is. So a lot of kids in Connecticut grow up close to the ocean. And yet, if you never travel to the ocean or engage in inquiry about the ocean, that doesn't mean you may not be kind of developing coastal literacy that would lead you to protect the ocean. So
interesting.
We had a bunch of high school and middle school science teachers from across the state. And we asked them to do this survey of coastal literacy, or of ocean literacy, really, that had been developed by a researcher in Florida and used all over the place. And when we had them come and tell us in a focus group, like, how'd that go, blah, 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 they were like, well, the survey was really hard because the questions were written in this really difficult way. And so we, like, the kids weren't showing what they knew. And I said, oh, that makes sense. So can you rewrite some of them? And they all chose different questions that they would have rewritten, and they all rewrote them differently than each other. So what it's telling me is one possibility, this is one possibility, is that each one of them had created a way that their use of language is the only exposure their kids had to these ideas. And if you ask them a different way, they can't do it.
So it's an idiosyncratic way of talking about very complex ideas, and that doesn't get the kid very far.
Like, it's cool that you came up with this super simple way to explain it to somebody, but if they can't then read and write about it, then they really can only know that in your class.
Wow. Yes. Yep. Super interesting. And I hear the participation part in this chapter, talking about that gradual release of participation. And that kind of leads to this idea of really, what is the student's experience? Mm-hmm. Seems like something that can be, that seems like you're really hitting at, where you think about things like when you're talking about considering use and interaction rather than knowledge and acquisition and memorization, moves mm-hmm. teachers towards more active pedagogies. So you're really thinking about providing students access to a different experience. I mean, what it means to do school should feel completely different.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. This is the vision. and I think in some spots, this is the reality. I don't want to minimize where people are really doing this. But I don't think it's sort of the stereotypical assumption that we have about what it feels like to be in school.
Interesting. And that's kind of always the rub when we think about these things that make sense when we think about how to support kids, or when we think about research. What do you think are the, why, if this is so good, why is it not happening more often to have a student experience like when students are explicitly given a reason for reading, you say, it changes how the text is read or written. Again, that really makes me think about the student's experience is completely different. They're doing the thing, like you say. Mm-hmm. So why do we not have more kids doing the thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I think the answer to that's, and this is an important question for folks that are like coaching teachers or that are leading in a building. I think people have, people come to the work from different places and they bring different strengths to it, and they may need different kinds of support to get it all the way home. So one of the common things that people think about, especially in STEM fields, although I think this is shifting, but it certainly has been a concern historically, is that teachers don't have the disciplinary knowledge. Haven't had personal experience using this content to do anything in the world. And therefore, they are not making those connections for students because it is purely academic to them.
Purely academic, what do you mean? Do you mean it's purely academic, meaning for them it is also a case of something they're watching and not doing?
Yep.
Okay.
So like, if you're teaching a mathematical concept that you don't use or have never used, I mean, I don't mean to suggest that like science teachers need to go home and titrate every day. Like, so, you know.
Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Titrated for a reason, then their teaching of titration is going to be different. And this is This is the idea behind like research experience for experiences for science teachers. And there's a whole body of programs and ideas around that, but I think it extends to everything. So in some cases, when I do rounds at high school, sometimes the best disciplinary or the most disciplinary instruction is coming from arts, tech ed, and music, because those people are more likely to leave work and do their thing.
Wow. Oh, that's
in some cases, like an English teacher has to read so many papers, they can't do their thing. but the question is, right. Have you ever done the thing? Do you remember why you would read a novel? Do you remember what you could do with a screenplay? Like, do you remember that it's not just for the quiz? It's because these are used to do things in the world that matter.
Oh, that's so amazing. So if I hear you right, you're saying that our teachers in trades and our teachers in the arts are actually positioned in a way to do disciplinary literacy in more powerful, or maybe take them up easier than our core teachers.
Can be. It can be. Yeah. And so I've seen them be leaders in it. Like, which is great, because it's often like the academic teachers and then like the also ran. when I'm around for PD days, it's like, this was designed for English and math. Everybody else can come too, you know?
Yes.
It's a nice flip, especially in terms of literacy, which is usually like English gets a free pass and everybody else has to, I don't mean a free pass in terms of responsibility,
but yes.
They're doing literacy PD. We assume English knows and everybody else needs to
sit through it. They have street cred, as the kids say.
Right. Yeah.
So we
assume competence there. And that's really the thing. Like, it's just, it's a good example of how, if we assume that kids won't be able to do these things, we will not give them opportunities to, we'll give them easy, simple, drag them through, push them through examples. And if we think we presume they're competent, imagine that they could, if not today, then on their way, be full participants one day, then we'll design instruction that takes them there if we have an idea of what that looks like.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. There's so many hard pieces there. The giving students the time and giving teachers the time and the space to really think about what it means to do the things in the discipline when they've already got so much going on.
Right.
And then also when there are all those other competing factors that teachers have to deal with, trying to think about making space for all kids to be successful when there's so much pressure on standardized test scores, graduation rates. And when you think, as a teacher, I have to move the needle.
There's
a lot of interest.
Another answer to your question about why don't people do more of this is because the job of secondary teachers has been either implicitly or explicitly turned into make these outcomes happen.
Yes.
And folks have figured out ways to do that in some cases. And so that's what they're doing.
Yes.
And in some cases, not all. And so this is one of those things where we don't necessarily need to see you kind of engaging in discipline specific literacy instruction every day, 180 days a year, in order to be, you know, moving in the right direction.
Right.
But in some cases, less is more. Like, kids are more successful when their work is more authentic, even if it doesn't look like what we've been trained to think is rigor. It looks like participation. Doesn't look like, perfect outline notes. If that's not the way that people organize information in your discipline, then it doesn't need to be Cornell notes.
Yes.
It can be, but it doesn't need to be. Certainly doesn't need to be all the time.
That's so interesting. And then it almost seems like in spaces and places where you have that pressure, it seems like that freedom may not be given as much, which is interesting.
Yep.
And so if the teacher does not have that freedom to explore and go out on a limb for a child, That's so interesting.
Yeah, I hear that.
Oh, well, I really, really appreciate this. I think it's really helped me understand chapter two better. And really, when I hear you write, I really hear the focus on the idea of disciplinary literacy is really trying to create a different experience of what it means to do school for a kid. So I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to talking to you more.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity, Richard.